Welcome to the Latchkey Tales, Book 3, The Widows of Rincon Hill, a tale of horticultural horror, written and performed for podcast by M.J. Hahn. Chapter 6, McDirch and Sons of Butchertown. Yuki wriggled in an uneasy sleep while her fever burned. The widows weren't quite sure what to do with the strange girl in the ruined gown who had fainted in the middle of the morning room, so they had cleared out a corner of the loft in the carriage house, where a cot had been set out. They would let the girl's fever run its course, and that way, in case it was something serious, the girl wouldn't infect the entire household. Mrs. Crisp was amenable to this, even though she had a strong dislike for the carriage house's rickety stairwell.
You can be sure I'll break my neck running up and down those blasted stairs. And now I've got to look after a sick girl on top of everything else?
Her complaints went largely unanswered. As far as the housekeeper, Mrs. Leach, was concerned, they should have left the girl at the curb with the cans for the slop wagons. Despite her dim view, Mrs. Leach had given the dusty loft a cursory cleaning, making things as comfortable as she thought appropriate. She had brought up a stand for a wash basin and a pitcher for water, as well as a little side table next to the cot with barely enough room for a candlestick and a box of matches. Days passed, and when Yuki wasn't sleeping, she could hear the distant sound of a harpsichord tinkling from somewhere inside the house. Clearly, someone was practicing, since they attempted to play the same piece over and over again with varying degrees of success. And then there was the constant smell of cooking wafting in from the kitchen at all hours, enough to make Yuki wonder how many people Mrs. Crisp could possibly be feeding. One morning, she woke to find Mrs. Crisp hovering over her while wearing a dishcloth tied around her head like some sort of bandit nurse. She mopped at Yuki's brow with a cool cloth and tried to get her to swallow a few spoonfuls of bland broth. It was all Yuki could do to keep the few mouthfuls down. Mrs. Crisp also brought a trailing entourage of round-peering faces that were bobbing up alternately from the head of the rickety stairwell. They seemed to be chittering between bites of their pastries.
Does she still have a fever? She must have gotten her feet wet.
She got her feet wet? Is she gonna die like Marianne Dashwood?
An infection of putrid tendency.
I told you, that's not what happened. Marianne never died.
But it's been days and days. Why hasn't she died yet?
Will we still be able to bury her in the garden?
Oh, I hope so. Everything's been planned and Miles has written the loveliest eulogy.
Mrs. Crisp collected her things and turned, causing a sudden stampede of little feet down the stairs. Except for little Nigel.
If there's a funeral, will there be a special luncheon as well?
Mrs. Crisp shushed him with a little kick to his ample backside, and they both disappeared down the stairs. It was some time later that night that Yuki found herself lying in her cot, staring at the rafters overhead, unsure if she was awake or not. The loft was flooded with moonlight pouring in from the single window of her makeshift bedroom. The pale silver light played tricks on the eyes. Yuki thought that she could see small round faces peering at her from the shifting shadows. For a moment, she thought that the roaming pack of orphans had returned. Yuki sat up in her cot and then shuddered as the faces suddenly vanished. Her breath caught in her throat, and her stomach gave a familiar little twist when she saw the tall, pale woman standing in the moonlight. Of course, it wasn't the first time that Yuki had seen something like this. And again, to say that the strange woman was pale may have been an understatement. Transparent might have been a more accurate description. She was staring down into the garden, her face hidden behind a curtain of dark waves that reached down to her waist in a long, snarled braid. Yuki could hear her murmuring in a hushed, hissing voice.
Suffer, little children.
In the shadows, Yuki thought she could see the small round faces shifting in and out of view as the woman hissed again.
He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live.
The woman turned, revealing a dark column of dried blood that had stained the front of her tattered negligee. She held a small bundle in her arms, creating a ghoulish vision of mother and child. The bundle's fabric parted to reveal a delicate pale hand with tiny fingers that had turned blue long ago. A faint whimpering cry emanated from within the small bundle, sending a chill down Yuki's spine. The woman's face remained shadowed behind a tangle of curls that fell as her head bent to nuzzle the swaddled form. The crying ceased, replaced by a tiny, haunting giggle that tinkled on the air like ice crystals. A sudden rush of bone-chilling cold blew Yuki's hair back as the figures promptly vanished. Yuki's eyes snapped open, and this time she was sure she was awake. The loft was dim with a pale violet light, so murky it made it difficult to tell whether it was early morning or evening. One thing was certain. The worst of the shadows had gone, and mercifully, there were no strange apparitions standing in her window. Yuki crawled out of her cot and was happy to note that she had enough strength to take a few steps. Her feet creaked on the uneven floorboards as she limped over to the window. She peered out into the garden, rubbing the sleep out of her eyes. As her vision cleared, she saw a dark-covered carriage driven by a pale, slumped-back horse. She read, "McDirch and Sons of Butchertown," painted in streaked letters on the dirty oilcloth that made up the wagon's cover. In the garden, Yuki could see shadowy figures moving along the lush wall of roses. There were three of them, a larger man directing the other two, who were both small and scrawny. They struggled to keep a steady hold on the wooden ladders and the empty burlap sacks they had slung over their shoulders. The large man barked his orders.
"Jody, you get going over on the east side fence. Cage will start over here. Be sure you watch out for those thorns when you start your snipping. These blooms don't take too kindly to a harsh pruning."
Cager set his ladder upright against the iron fence. He went to make sure it was steady and pulled back, suddenly sucking on one of his fingertips. The large man laughed while the boy winced.
"What did I tell you, Cager? Them widow roses got some wicked thorns. You watch yourself now."
Cager looked sullen and gripped a formidable pair of shears. He hooked his burlap sack on his belt and scrambled up the ladder. One by one, he carefully snipped away at the wall of roses while collecting the deep red blooms in his burlap sack. The large man surveyed this for a while. When he seemed satisfied that progress was being made, he turned and approached the carriage house. Yuki shrank back, peering out of the corner of her window. The man was broad and burly, with a weathered face mostly hidden by a grizzled cloud of beard. The large carriage house doors groaned in protest as he pulled them open. The man began rummaging in the shadows while softly singing to himself.
"Dunderbeck, oh Dunderbeck, how could you be so mean? How'd you go invent such a horrible machine? The long-tailed rats and pussycats no longer will be seen. He'll grind them up to sausage meat in Dunderbeck's machine."
Yuki was able to peer between the cracks in the floorboards and watched as the man pulled a tarp off of the strange contraption in the corner. A gleam of copper flashed, and she remembered catching a glimpse of it before. The copper drum, similar to the ancient tea maker in the supply room at the Bell Fair. Yuki crept along, being careful of the squeaky floorboards while she tried to get a better view. The man went on whistling the strange little tune while he fumbled around in the dim light. He stood with his back to her, his massive frame blocking any chance of her seeing what he was up to. There was a sudden groan of metal as the copper drum's heavy lid swung open. Yuki had to shrink back again as the man looked up to grab hold of the chain hanging overhead. It rattled and clanged until the lid was securely fastened in place. Then the man disappeared out of view, his whistling accompanying the dull thud of his boots. There was another clang, then the sound of a valve turning, followed by rushing water as the copper drum began to fill itself. There was a clicking sound and the familiar whoosh of a pilot light coming to life. The man came back into view, looking pleased at his progress, and then his smile sort of collapsed when he saw the two small women dressed head to toe in black standing in the carriage house doorway. Mrs. Bilsey spoke up first.
"Arrived at last, young McDirch. I see your boys are already busy at their pruning. I do hope you gave them adequate instruction."
Young McDirch wrung his massive hands together, looking a little meek.
"Oh, good morning there, Mrs. C&B. I hope you're both keeping well. Don't you worry. Jody and Cager are doing a top-notch job.
Mrs. Bilsey seemed dubious at this.
You are cutting it rather fine, aren't you? As you well know, the pruning should be done in the dead of night. If this blunder affects our yield, there will be hell to pay. I do fear for those young men. The blooms are most disagreeable if you try to cut them when they're awake. And we don't need any extra mess just now, you see.
Chimed in Mrs. Carstairs, trying to look pleasant. Mrs. Bilsey rolled her eyes.
What she means is, unnecessary complications or delays shall not be tolerated. Especially with Mrs. Grimshaw returning earlier than we had originally planned.
A fine beading of sweat had broken out on young McDurch's forehead.
Oh, you say Mrs. G is coming back to town? And so soon?
Mrs. Bilsey nodded.
Indeed. It seems that she fell upon some mischance while abroad, so I'm sure she won't be in the mood to be trifled with when she arrives.
McDurch blew out his cheeks as the copper drum finally began to steam.
Water's looking almost ready for them pedals once the boys are finished snipping them.
He turned his attention to a different contraption set against the opposite wall.
The rest won't be too much of a bother. I brought 2 sacks of potash for your hopper there. Once we get her filled up and the water running through it, you'll have more lye than you'll know what to do with.
The widows looked pleased as young McDurch continued.
And that's some fine, fancy new pipework I see you got put in there.
He motioned from the suspended oblong box that he had called the hopper to the new copper pipes that led down to a large, empty wooden barrel partially hidden under the stairs.
The feller who rigged this up must be some sort of genius. Never seen a newfangled contraption like that before.
Mrs. Carstairs brightened and nodded back to the busily steaming copper drum.
Yes, and he redesigned our little essence extractor over there and then built the entire thing himself. He's a local fellow, so helpful and so polite. He has proved to be quite talented, but he'll put himself out of business since he works for practically nothing.
Finished Mrs. Bilsey with a little smirk. McDurch's eyebrows twitched and he muttered under his breath.
You'll never get rich in this town by doing favors for the wrong people, that's for sure.
Mrs. Bilsey's flinty eyes twinkled.
I beg your pardon? I didn't quite catch that.
Young McDurch sidestepped the tricky situation by returning his attention to the enormous barrel under the stairs.
Of course, you ladies remember the egg test for the lye water. After a day or so, once that water's gone good and reddish brown, a fresh egg that bobs just beneath the surface is perfect. If she sinks, the batch is still too weak. And you be sure to watch your fine little hands around that lye water. It'll burn you something fierce.
One of the boys came in from the garden, dragging several burlap sacks in each hand that were filled to bursting with the dark red blooms. His arms were crisscrossed with deep bloody scratch marks. The bloodshed didn't seem to faze McDurch as he waved the boy over.
That's a fine job now, Jody. Why don't you leave those over here and go see if Cager needs a hand?
The boy did as he was instructed and sulked back out into the garden. McDurch began sifting through the flowers, twisting them in his massive hands so that the petals came loose. He began tossing handfuls into the steaming water, and the aroma instantly filled the carriage house. This seemed to please the widows to no end as they each paused to close their eyes and take deep breaths of the heady vapor. McDurch nodded again as he squeezed one of the petals between his finger and thumb.
Never ceases to amaze me how fast these roses grow back. Seems like we was just here not too long ago.
Mrs. Carstairs beamed at the swirling petals.
This particular variety does have a certain fecundity, doesn't it?
McDurch bent to grab the nearest burlap sack, and a shower of crimson soon followed as he made quick work of separating the velvety petals from their stems.
You can already tell this will make another fine batch of that fancy rose bath soap you ladies love so well.
The widows sighed in agreement while they inhaled.
It's lovely, isn't it? Such a delightful and complex sweetness, like the tears of an angel,
lilted Mrs. Carstairs. She glanced over at Mrs. Bilsey and was surprised to see her tiny mouth curled into a smile.
Quite a sublime bouquet. It reminds one of so many summer evenings long gone by. So jocular, so frolicsome.
Mrs. Bilsey suddenly collected herself.
Oh dear, I believe I may have gotten a hint of its therapeutic effect already.
McDurch, taking advantage of the momentary mirth, weighed his words carefully.
Looks like you ladies have everything you'll need. Except, of course, for your tallow. I suppose you're employing this same mysterious supplier as per usual?
The widow's good humor instantly evaporated, and they both fixed their gaze on McDurch.
I'm sorry, that particular commodity has always been Miss Grimshaw's forte. She does insist on the finest quality.
Oh, yes, my dear man, only the finest quality, and she's very persnickety, you see.
The beads of sweat bloomed on McDurch's forehead once more.
Oh, of course, of course! What about if you told me who she's buying from? I guarantee I could get you a better deal. Old McDurch has some prize blue ribbon hogs that are nice and fattened up. I know he'd let you have them for practically nothing. The finest in Butchertown, I guarantee it.
The widows looked at each other and then back to young McDurch.
We're all quite aware of how you and your dear family hold court in that part of town.
Need I remind you that this is Rincon Hill, my good man. Quite a world away from Butchertown.
McDurch went as crimson as the rose petals, until Cager and Jody came clomping in from the garden, which sent him suddenly pale. Half of Jody's face was hidden behind a shining mask of blood. He had acquired several new deep scratches across his neck as well, but it was Cager who looked the worse for wear. Aside from his face and hands, which had been horribly scratched, his shirt was hanging in strips like it had been shredded and perforated by countless tiny knives. What was left was dotted with spots of blood that began to darken and spread. Mrs. Bilsey observed this with a little smirk and then looked back at McDurch.
Perhaps you should worry about keeping these little piglets alive first,
Yes, dear man. Rest assured, we have things well in hand.
The widows departed side by side, their heads lowered together, quietly chatting as they returned to the house. McDurch mopped his brow and barked his orders again. The boys dabbed the blood out of their eyes and started to tear the remainder of the flowers apart with obvious relish. When they had finished, the surface of the water bobbed and bubbled with a ruffled carpet of crimson. McDurch reached above and unhooked the chain he had fastened to the heavy lid. He brought it down slowly and then had the boys help him spin down and lock a series of clamps in place. McDurch tapped at the vent valve on the thing's lid as it began to emit a steady cone of rose-scented steam. He checked the remaining gauges and then guided the boys back outside towards the wagon. They had their ladders loaded just as the horizon began to glow with the fiery orange of the approaching dawn. High above in her hiding place, Yuki watched as the McDurch and Sons wagon rolled away. Suddenly, she realized that she felt a little cold and wobbly from standing so long and decided to return to the relative comfort of her cot. She turned to find Mrs. Leech and her cat-green eyes illuminated at a rather alarming angle by the oil lamp she held in one hand. She had a neat stack of folded clothes tucked under her other arm.
I see you've managed to get yourself out of bed, finally. I assume your malady has subsided?
Mrs. Leech's tone had an instantly sobering effect, and Yuki found herself standing up a little straighter.
Yeah, I'm feeling better, thank you. Things still seem a little foggy, though. How long was I out for, anyway?
Mrs. Leech's eyes flashed.
You've been ill for 7 days, and it's only due to the kindness of the ladies' hearts that you weren't thrown back out into the street after that appalling display in the morning room.
The severity of Mrs. Leech's stare indicated that the whole throwing back out into the street part had obviously been her idea. Yuki looked sheepish and lowered her eyes.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cause any problems.
Mrs. Leech pounced on this.
Spare me your feeble blandishments. You girls all sing a variation of the same tune. I've heard them all before, so save your breath.
Yuki nodded a little awkwardly, managing to say nothing, and Mrs. Leech actually looked pleased at once for her silence.
Since you've already incurred a certain obligation to the household during your convalescence, you can settle your debt to the ladies by filling the position for which you did not quite successfully apply.
Yuki nodded again.
Okay.
Mrs. Leech glided silently across the uneven floorboards and set the stack of folded clothing on the cot.
See if these fit you, then find Mrs. Crisp in the kitchen. We have a very important arrival today, and I want everything positively gleaming.
Even though she thought she knew the answer, Yuki couldn't help asking the question anyway.
Who is arriving?
The cat green eyes narrowed, and Yuki realized that had been a bad idea.
Never you mind whom. You've not been allowed to stay so that you may ask impertinent questions. You're here to do your job, and I'm quite sure Mrs. Crisp already has a dizzying array of tasks awaiting you.
Her speech broke off and her long nose twitched.
But you'll need to see to yourself first. There's a certain pungency about your person. You'll find soap and a towel by the wash basin.
Yuki managed a feeble
okay
before Mrs. Leech disappeared down the rickety stairwell. Yuki unfolded the clothes that had been left for her and discovered the requisite housemaid uniform. There was a plain gray skirt that reached down to her ankles, a matching long-sleeve top, as well as a white apron with a lot of pockets, and something else that she guessed was underwear. Yuki blew out her cheeks and let the pile flop back down onto the cot. She poured some water into the wash basin, splashed her face, and felt a little better. She saw her green silk reticule hanging on a nail next to the ruin of her grandmother's gown. She fumbled for the tiny handbag and pulled the drawstring open. Her few meager possessions were still inside, the ring of house keys and the inert lump that had been her cell phone. She reached in and grabbed it, relieved to see that the crack across its shiny screen hadn't gotten any worse. Just holding on to it gave her a comforting and oddly secure feeling, even though the poor phone had died a miserable, watery death. Yuki rolled her eyes.
Who am I supposed to call in 1885 anyway?
She pressed the power button out of habit, and her eyes lit up when the phone screen suddenly flickered to life. She smiled when she saw the face grinning up at her.
Crowley.
It was the last picture she had taken that night on Pier 23. Crowley was making a cheesy face from under his top hat with the blur of Admiral Heirloom's Night Fair behind him. She was able to swipe through all the pictures they had taken that night. More shots of her and Crowley in front of various attractions than one of her standing between the doctor and Mrs. Flack. She touched the picture of the doctor's face. She hadn't exactly had a chance to even wonder what everybody must be going through since her mysterious disappearance. Somehow she had to believe that GT and Crowley would come up with some way to get her back to her own time. She just didn't happen to have a clue what that might be, or how they would even begin to find her in the first place. Yuki stared down at her phone again and closed the set of pictures. The tiny glimpse of technology was encouraging, so out of habit she tapped a few keys, being careful of the broken screen. There was a strange little twinge from inside the phone, like it suddenly realized where it was. It sputtered like it didn't quite have the coping skills to deal with the situation. A few unable to find location and network error messages flashed until it finally gave up the ghost with another little sputter before the screen went black again. Yuki frowned and fiddled with the power switch. Despite her best effort, the sad broken screen remained resolutely dark. She decided that it might be better to let the poor phone rest for a while and tucked it away into one of the pockets of her apron. She appraised the remainder of her uniform with a little sigh, wondering exactly what sort of dizzying tasks Mrs. Crisp had waiting for her in the widow's crazy kitchen. And so, Chapter 6 comes to a close. Special thanks go to guest voices on this episode, Leanne Parker as Yuki. Music on the program provided by freesound.org and incomptech.com. For more information, please check out the Latchkey Tales fan page on Facebook. And now the Latchkey Tales can also be found on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Please stay tuned for Chapter 7. And until then, this is MJ Hahn saying goodbye for now, and thanks for listening.